everyone. Happy Monday. Yes, I did record Beth's teaching yesterday, and if you go to reginadonacres.com, you'll find it there. So, so it is there, and it is available to be listened to. So again, happy Monday. Last night, we never did get around to starting the seven steps, so that is what we're going to do today. We're going to start the seven steps. We're going to begin at number 435, which is where we are to go next. The last one we did was 434. I am pasting in the room right now a link to my journal, number 435. If anyone is listening on the radio and you want to get to the journal, you can go to RDA7. That is the digit 7. It is not spelled out. RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. You can use the menu bar across the top, click on step 2, or you can use the menu bar down the right-hand side and scroll down underneath step 2. And then you want to click on the numbering sequence that is going to allow you to find your way to number 435, which is where we are beginning today. And what I would like to do is just start with, I think a little bit of music is what I'd like to start with. But what I have in my hand is Beth's CD. So, in fact, Beth's CD is already in the CD player from when she taught here yesterday. So why don't we listen to a song from Beth's CD? The one that has just now jumped out at me is Child of the Light. So we'll start by listening to Child of the Light, which is track number 7 on Lift the Veil. That's Beth Teamy's CD. And here we go.
No longer have faith in darkness. denying the light of day. I'll trust God's voice within me to show me ever his way. For I'm a child of light, a child of light. I'm a child of light, and I will worship the dark no more. I'm a child of light, a child of light. I'm a child of light, and I will worship the dark no more.
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right, so what I'm going to do then is just go ahead and open up the Seven Steps to Awakening to number 435. We are in step two. The quotes that we are reading are still coming from the Supreme Yoga, Yoga Vasistha. And, oh, you give the link again? All right, I can give the link again. There you are. There's the link again. And I'm going to start by reading the quote in the book. Here we go. There is no such thing as creation. And by the way, just in case you read A Course in Miracles a lot and you have one idea of what creation means, he means it differently here. By creation, he means this physical world. There is no such thing as creation. You are neither the doer of actions nor the enjoyer of experiences. You are the all, ever at peace, unborn, and perfect. Again. There is no such thing as creation. You are neither the doer of actions nor the enjoyer of experiences. You are the all, ever at peace, unborn, and perfect. All right, let's look at the journal, number 435. And it looks like this is an inquiry process. Can it be said that I is true self, and anything that can be separated from I is not true self? And again, just as a review, I is just a symbol. But it's a symbol for that self that I have noticed through this inquiry process that is always present, completely changeless, and although it's known, it cannot be observed like an object can be observed. Can it be said that I is true self, and anything that can be separated from I is not true self? And the answer is yes. When anything that can be separated from I is experienced as self, that is imposter self, that can be said. So in other words, what this is saying is that I have noticed a changelessness that is so core to what I am, that there is also a realization that anything that appears to change cannot be what I am. Because reason says, I cannot be the changeless and the changing too. And since this changelessness is always present, and changes seem to come and go, whether I seem to be the enjoyer today, or the sad one today, or the angry one today, or the busy one today, or the bored one today, those things come and go. But the changeless one is always here, regardless of what other aspects seem to be here. So the changeless one must be what I am, and the happy one, the sad one, the busy one, the bored one, that must not be what I am. And when I think I am one of those, that's just being identified with an imposter self. So I am bored, for example, is a false statement. Right? That's a false statement. So the next question then in the inquiry is, what is the doer of actions? I, or imposter self? And the answer in looking becomes clearly, it is the imposter. Because you can watch the doer. In fact, I was just doing, before we started this inquiry, I was doing it. I was noticing how I began to speak. And there was a realization that happened. I'm going to teach. Like, teaching is going to happen, and it's going to happen through here. But what was interesting was the point of view that I was observing that from. Was not the point of view of what seems to be, what you could say is the, it's not the point of view of one who believes I am the teacher. It was another point of view, observing that teaching was going to happen now. And this teaching was going to come through here. These experiences of watching the little S self in a way that I really don't know how to describe, but I'm going to call it in a detached way, are becoming more and more common. There's more and more of an awareness that I am not the body, that I am not the doer. In fact, I watch, I can see the Regina personality, and I know what Regina's preferences are, what Regina wants to do, what Regina does not want to do. And then I also watch what this body does, the same body that people would call Regina. I watch what it says, and I notice that there are things coming through it. The body is doing things. The body is volunteering for things that Regina has no interest in. And then there's this watcher that's somehow observing all of this. Just watching it like you watch a movie. And there's not an answer to the question, you know, there's not an answer to the question, well, what moves Regina? If Regina is not interested in X, Y, and Z, not at all interested, the personality is not at all interested, and yet she says it, she does it, what's moving her? What's moving her to take actions that she has no interest in taking? And there isn't really an answer. There's nothing that I can point to and say, well, I can see that it's that thing that's moving her. Like, I can see the Regina personality, I can point at it. I can see the movement that's happening. I can point at it and say, look what's being done. But there's nothing that I can point at and say, and that's the mover. Nothing. There's no object that appears to be moving Regina And in fact, more and more and more, I'm seeing there's not even a decision. Literally, Regina could be thinking, I don't want to be here right now. I don't want to do this right now. And even while that thought is happening, the speaking and the movement is occurring, and no one else would be at all aware of that thinking. And then there's just the watching of that. Like everything is happening. The thinking is happening. The personality is happening. The action that is not at all related to the personality is happening. And then there's this watching of all of that. And one thing I've come to realize lately is that the vast majority of the people that are in my presence could not possibly understand me now. Because the vast majority of the people that are in my presence still believe their personality. And they still think thoughts like, I want this, I don't want that. And then somehow their actions are still attached to that thinking. And so they don't see any separation between their thinking and their actions. Therefore, when they look at me, there has to be an assumption that my actions are aligned with my thinking. And they don't understand that right now I'm in some kind of a state of, discordance? Is that a word? Discordance? Where it's like there's this personality thing that has these thoughts. And then there's this body thing, which best way to describe it is just an empty vessel that's being moved. And then there's a watcher. And I don't know exactly what even all of this means, except that this has been my experience now for recent weeks. But if it's doing anything, what it's doing is it's telling me that I am something other than the personality. And I am something other than the body. And I am also something other than what is said or what actions seem to be taken here. And to point at any of those things and say, that's me. If you point at the personality and you say, that's Regina. Or if you point at what I appear to be saying or appear to be doing and you say, that's Regina. Somehow you're wrong. Somehow you're wrong. And not only that, but if you point at what your personality is thinking, or you point at what you are doing, and you say, that's me, you're equally wrong. What's interesting about this particular quote that we just read from the Supreme Yoga is it says, you are neither the doer of actions nor the enjoyer of experiences. You're neither one of those things. This is my experience now. This is what I'm living, is the awareness that I am neither of these things. And I'm at a loss when people want to do something like ask for my opinion. Maybe I'm entering into that phase that the Course talks about where you have to say, I don't know who I am. I can see an opinion here, and I could give it, but to say that's my opinion is weird. It's not right. It's not true. I could say that's the Regina personality opinion. That's what I can say. Now, I know what the Regina personality opinion is. The Regina personality would think yada, yada, yada. But I can no longer claim that as my opinion. And I can't even claim the apparent fact that I'm sitting here teaching now. I can't even claim that, like it's just happening. And if I went into the thinking to start saying, why is it happening? My thinking is so separate from my actions now. My thinking would say, well, if it was up to me, I wouldn't be here. I'd be off doing X, Y, and Z. I don't want to be here right now. I want to be over there. I have this to do and that to do. You know, like nothing is aligned, and the fact that nothing is aligned somehow is emphasizing the fact that none of it is what I always thought it was. Because again, there's this watcher watching the non-alignment of the personality and the body. Apparently there's been something. There's been enough surrender, or there's been enough detachment, enough non-believing that's occurred, that the body is now free to be moved regardless of the personality's thoughts. So there's not a connection between the two like there used to be an apparent connection. And this is what's allowing the watching. But in the watching, what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing, is exactly what this quote is talking about. That I am neither the doer. I can't claim the doing. Nor am I the enjoyer of experiences, the personality. I can't claim it either. I can see it, but I can't claim it. So again, what is the doer of actions? I or the imposter self? It has to be the imposter because I can see it. What enjoys experiences or suffers from them? Likewise, it has to be the imposter. That's the personality. I can see that. Now, what's interesting is the next question. The next question is, if something is depressed at the scene, what is depressed? The answer, the reason this question came into the inquiry is because on this date, which was May 10th, 2012, I was just beginning this scene. I was at the cusp of this scene. And when I was just at the beginning of this scene, and there was a realization that I am not the personality, that I am not the doer, that was really beginning to arrive, there was still enough wanting to be the personality or wanting to be the doer that there was a sense of sadness at the scene. I literally felt sad. Like a death was occurring. The death of this Regina thing. And that's why this next question came into the inquiry. If something is depressed at this scene, what is depressed? What this question did was this caused me to look and say, what is depressed? This caused me to look and see if the changeless self had just become depressed. And the changeless self had not changed. Which means even the depression at the death of Regina, at the beginning of that death, at seeing that that death was coming, that soon I would not be able to honestly say I am Regina. I may say that, but not in the way I did before. That which was depressed was still the false self. Because there was no change in the changeless as the scene occurred. So the answer to the question, if something is depressed at the scene, what is depressed, was the imposter self. It seems the depression comes from attachment belief to the idea, I am the person self. It also seems that attachment remains in spite of this clear guidance from within, because person self is the overwhelming day-to-day experience, while omnipresent self or non-local has not been experienced. In other words, I do not yet know myself as the all through direct experience. I can't say that. And so letting go of the personality self and the body self, the person self, is sad because I want to be something. I want the all to be some kind of an experience that it's something and I know I'm that. And without this strong experience of the all being something and I know I'm that, I don't want to give up this little something. Because I want to be something. It's kind of like saying, I'm willing to let go of being a teacher if I know that now I'm going to be a counselor. Or I'm willing to let go of being a student if I know now I'm going to be a professional or a housewife or a mother. I'm willing to let go of what I'm identified with now if I know what I can be identified with next. But the idea of no identification saddens me. That's what this says. It's funny as I'm looking at this now because I am in a different place now than when it was originally written. And now, like I said, I do have these experiences with some regularity, of seeing the Regina personality, like even the laugh just now, of seeing it in a way that is like watching a movie on a screen. I'm seeing it from somewhere else. I wasn't having this experience on May 10th when this was written, when this scene just started. I'm watching from someplace else. But see, I can't tell you where that someplace else is. And on this day, May 10th, the thought of stepping into that someplace else without knowing what it was or having something to identify with, that saddened me. It doesn't look like the fact that it saddened me put a halt on the experience that was begun on this day, because that experience is becoming stronger and stronger. So the fact that I was sad about it doesn't really mean anything. Like I said, it was kind of like a death was about to happen and I was sad about it. I continued to write on this day, although changeless being can be intuited and is known to be more stable or more real than mind self, there is doubt that beingness is non-local, which also leads to doubt regarding I am not the body and the world is not real. It seems that focus on changeless being can lead to an honest peace that passeth understanding, while death can still lead to death. What I've written here is honest. Self-honesty is very, very important. And if we are going to awaken to our true self, one of the things that we have to do is look honestly at the beliefs and the doubts that we're still holding on to. And so what's happening on this day that I'm beginning to look at the idea of the death of Regina, or the breakup of that identification with her at the very least. I do recognize, I've already at this point intuited the I, the true self, the changeless self, enough to know that there is something there, you could say, to catch me when I fall. When I fall away from being Regina, I know that there's something there, something that's always been there, something that I already am. I'm aware of that. But I have a problem, and the problem is coming from the mind, by the way. I have a problem. A problem that keeps me from wanting to let go and do that falling. And the problem Like if we take this quote, 435, as an example, he says, you are the all. The problem is that I have an imagination of what it should feel like to be the all. My imagination tells me that if I'm the all, I should not be perceiving from a local position like a body. I should not be, for example, looking out of a body's eyes and seeing a clock in front of me. If I'm the all, I should equally feel like the clock somehow looking out and seeing a body. I've never had that experience. Yeah, I remember Joe Wolf talking about an experience he had in a prison cell, when the way he described it was he expanded and he became first, I think he said, his cot. And then he expanded and he was also the floors and the walls of the cell. And if I remember his experience correctly, I'm not getting it mixed up with someone else's, there was a window there and he then expanded out and he became everything. I've never had an experience of being everything. And my imagination says, I should. And because I haven't, there's a doubt in my mind that I'm the all. And if I'm not the all, then that does mean that I will die. Because the only way that I could exist forever is if I'm the all. I accept that the all never ends. It shifts and changes form. Form goes away. Form returns. But the all never ends. But if I'm not the all, then I'm going to die. And then I made a really big confession in this paragraph. My really big confession is that I think I can focus on this changelessness within myself, which still feels very local. And if I really focus on it, I can transcend the emotional personality. And I can experience peace no matter what appears to occur in this lifetime. I believe that. But that doesn't mean I'm the all. That somehow this changelessness could be local. This changelessness could still be separate from everything, and therefore it could die. So I could transcend, have an extremely peaceful life, and then die. And I'm not certain I'm even sad about that. Like if somebody, not that, if somebody came up to me and said, you know, Regina, the truth is all this talk about the truth isn't true. The truth is the best you can do is become perfectly happy in this lifetime, but you are going to die. There's no such thing as eternal life. I would say that's fine. Why wouldn't I want to be happy and die? Why be miserable and die? Happy and die sounds much better. I'll still do this. I would. In fact, at some point I made that decision. There was a point much earlier on the spiritual path when I said, how do I know that this is true? And I said, it doesn't matter because it's making me happier, so it's still worth it. So I'm not really sad. I was sad, you know, above about separating from the personality of Regina, separating from being something and then not having an identity. That for some reason made me sad. I'm not really sad about the idea that maybe I'm just going to transcend the emotional personality, but in the end, death is still death, the end of existence. I'm not sad about that. But I cannot say in all honesty that I believe I, even the changeless I is eternal. As long as the doubt remains, the doubt that says, I'm not the all, I'm only local. In other words, where there is separation, there must be death. And I cannot say that I know from my own direct experience that there is no separation. I can say I know from my own direct experience there is a changelessness in me. I know that. I've found that. But I've not had a direct experience that tells me I'm the all. That's what I'm saying here. And I'm exposing that doubt. It's just honesty. So, moving on. If we scroll underneath 435, underneath the comment and reply area, you will find 436. And there's a link to 436 in my journal. Hello, Jay. .436 in the Seven Steps to Awakening is very short. It says, the world has no basis at all. The world has no basis at all. All right, let's read the journal. Inquiry is continuing. Is there any proof that the world is real? Now, a thought must have flew into my mind when that question was asked, because the next question is actually addressing a thought that we don't see written here. The thought that must have flew into my mind when, is there any proof that the world is real, must have been something like, I can find about 6 billion people who will agree it is. You know, my dad, my daughter, you know, my neighbors, you know, I can find a whole lot of people that will look at the world and say, yes, it's here. And in fact, they'd think I was crazy if I said it's not here, right? And I'm going to find very few people that are going to agree with me that it's not here. And even among them, to be honest, it's mostly intellectual. When it comes down to problems in their own life, they're as wrapped up in those problems as anybody else. And that's because the truth is, they believe the world is real. So I guess the answer to the question that first came that we don't see written down here, is there any proof that the world is real? The answer was, well, hell, everybody agrees that it's real. Even those who say they don't, actually they do. You can tell by their stress level when their finances drop. You can tell. You can tell. So because that was the answer, the next question that came then was, can human agreement be proof of reality? So what? What if we all agree that it's real? Is that proof that it's real? Now that's a different question. There are many points on which humans do not agree. Politics is an example, right? Religion is an example. Gosh, you know, we had this shooting this weekend in Newtown, Connecticut, and people don't agree on the cause of the shooting and what needs to change in order to prevent new shootings. There are a lot of points on which humans do not agree. And I can concede that where there isn't agreement, there also isn't reality. But what of points on which we do agree? For example, if I had, you know, I could get a bunch of people in this room right now. I could handpick some friends on Facebook that I know would not agree on a number of issues. Because you see them expressing their opinions enough, you know what they would agree and not agree on. I could get them in this room and I could ask them political questions and watch them disagree. I could ask them spiritual questions and watch them disagree. I could even ask them questions about how to prevent future mass shootings in America and watch them disagree. But then I could pick up this cup in my hand and I could say, is this a cup? And watch everybody go, oh yeah, that's a cup. The disagreement would stop. They all go, yeah, that's a cup. Yeah. There's nothing there to disagree on. So does that mean that this is a cup? The fact that we found something that we agree to, does our agreement that it's a cup make it a cup? So I said there are many points on which humans do not agree, and I can concede that where there isn't agreement, there also isn't reality. It's just opinion. I can agree with that. But what of the points on which we do agree? Can we agree that a telephone is a telephone, a tree is a tree, a flower is a flower, and a body is a body? If we agree on these basics, is this agreement proof of reality? This assignment was to use direct experience to verify reality while being honest with honesty beyond human honesty. And it says reference post 358. So what I'm doing right this second is I'm opening another tab in my window. And I'm going to my journal. I am clicking on step 2 on the menu bar. And then I'm clicking on item F, which will allow me to get to 358. And when I get to 358, I will post that in the room. This was written on April 6th, 2012. There you are if you also want to look at 358. You might want to open another tab so you don't lose 436. 358 says, it is time to be honest beyond the human definition of honesty. What is known, absolutely known from direct experience, and what is believed, learned and adopted as an idea of truth. Do not abandon honesty. Let critical honesty continuously answer this question until the true answer is clear. So what's interesting, this is the assignment. This is the assignment that is leading the inquiry that is happening in step two. This is where that inquiry began, with this assignment, to be honest beyond the human definition of honesty. So if my assignment is to be honest beyond the human definition of honesty, does that mean then that I am to believe this is a cup because all of the humans in the room agree it is a cup? It actually means that their agreement is not proof, because that would be stopping at human honesty. I mean, sure, everyone is honestly answering based on their perception. Everyone is honestly answering based on what they were taught. That is a cup, we were taught. Yes, that is a cup. Yes, the purpose of that is to put drinks in it and drink from them. But you know, somebody taught us that. So even though we're all being very honest in our perception of the cup and the purpose of the cup, that is only human honesty. And my assignment when this inquiry began was to look for an honesty that's beyond human honesty. What that means is our agreement that something is a fact is not proof that it is a fact. Even if we can get all 6.5 billion of us to agree on a point, that doesn't mean we're right. Human honesty is not the criteria I was asked to use. So going back to 436, if the honesty used must be beyond human honesty, then human agreement cannot be said to be a basis for verifying reality. If direct experience is the only basis for verifying if a phone is a phone, a tree is a tree, etc., then I honestly cannot say there is basis to call these perceptions fact. After all, the objects of the world are not directly experienced. They are observed, perceived. Only being is directly experienced. Therefore, only being is absolutely known as real. I talked a lot about this probably last week and maybe the week before. I think I used the example of the little boys that were either on America's Funniest Videos or on a YouTube, a viral YouTube, I don't remember which, but the little boys who were playing war and they were somehow ended up in the bathroom underneath the sink and they found their mother's tampons. And they had no idea what they were. They'd never seen their mother's tampons before. And at first there was a question, "Mama, what are these?" She was videoing them, so she was right there. And there was a question, "Mama, what are these?" But before she could answer, they processed within their own minds. And they made a decision. "Oh, it's dynamite." They decided it was play dynamite. And they were so happy to have found this box of play dynamite. Because it fit in perfectly with their game. And it was completely logical to them. And so for them, that was play dynamite. We can't actually know something through perception, through observation. If we were never taught to drink water out of a cup, if we were all taught, let's say that in order to drink, you do need some way to have the water piped in, but then we all had like drinking fountain type pipes, and we were taught to drink directly out of the drinking fountain. And maybe we even had these elaborate fancy fountains with long cords that we could bring to the table with different spouts so that while we were eating, we could all take a sip out of our little individual drinking, mobile drinking fountain. You know, we get very fancy with our technology and the way you drink. But the only concept of drinking that we've ever had is directly out of some type of a pipe. If somebody then brought in a cup, we wouldn't have any idea what it was until they taught us. Then it becomes a cup. And then maybe we would agree it was a cup, but before that, we wouldn't know what this thing was that we'd never seen before, never thought of before, we had no concept of. You know, I love to watch my dog. If you guys listen to my teachings regularly, you know that she often goes in and out, and you know that sometimes when she comes in, she is really dirty, and I'm not exaggerating that. Danielle once posted a picture on Facebook of how dirty Jamie can get in 5 minutes in the backyard when she gets out there and rolls around. But, you know, when I open that door to let Jamie in, Jamie doesn't have any concept of dirty. She just comes trotting right back in the house. She doesn't have any thought, "I'm too dirty to come into the house." I'm the one with the concept, "You're too dirty to come into the house." But you see, that's just an idea. There's no reality to it. If it was a reality, then Jamie would experience it also. You know. But there is something that Jamie experiences, and I experience, and you experience. And it's just being, existing, isness. We may have different concepts about everything else, or we may agree because we were taught to agree to that. But the only thing that we know directly is I am. Even without the words "I am," Jamie knows that. She knows she is. She doesn't even have to think about it. That's the only thing that's directly known. And if that's the only thing that's directly known, and if direct knowledge is the only proof of reality, that literally means there is no proof that the world is real. There's a perception, there's a belief, but there's no proof. And in fact, this is where the experience that I doubted in the previous entry, 435, now comes to the advantage. I said, I doubt I am the all because I don't experience myself as the all. And basically what this is saying is you do experience yourself as the all. The all isn't being the clock, being the cup, or being the dog. The all isn't extending from knowing your cot to knowing yourself as the floor and the walls, and then knowing yourself also as the things outside the window. The all is that one thing that is directly experienced, that beingness, that isness, that is the all. It's the only thing that can be known, and you know it. You're not separate from it. You know, it's interesting, it's a matter of perspective. If I look at myself as a body, and I look at this cup, I can say, I've never known myself as that cup. Therefore, I'm separate from it. And then I can go on to conclude things that are separate die. But if, with a slight shift in perception, by realizing that if it is observed, perceived, it is not real, it is nothing. In fact, remember 435 said there is no such thing as creation. Why would I need to expand into what isn't in order to know that I am? Why would my awareness have to expand into what isn't in order for me to know that I am? I already know that I am. I don't need that experience of expanding into the all. I know the one thing that can be known. So this shift in looking at it in this way erases the doubt. The doubt was coming from imagination of what being the all should feel like. But if the all is the one thing that could be directly known and does not involve what cannot be directly known, well, I do know that I know that. Therefore, I do know myself as the all. Let's move on to 437. You can scroll down and click on that. Plus, I will, of course, put the link in the room. In the Seven Steps to Awakening says, it is the movement of thought that appears as this world. It is the movement of thought that appears as this world. .437 in the journal says, honesty beyond human honesty is needed to verify reality because the human sees through mind, which is the maker of illusion. To use human honesty to verify truth is to verify perception and call it truth. If truth is sought, something more than human honesty is needed. This is why our agreement cannot verify the world. Our agreement cannot verify this cup is real. I've used the example before, you know, a few weeks back of stepping into a cartoon world, taking on a cartoon character and stepping into a cartoon world. If you're a cartoon character in a cartoon world, that world seems real to you. because it's the same as you. It's cartoon, like you are. Cartoon cannot verify reality because it's going to get confused and think that cartoon is real. Our illusory personality, our illusory personality mind, person mind, is going to get confused and think illusion is real. And because it has that ability to become confused, we cannot use it to make firm decisions about what is real and what is not real. We need something beyond it, beyond the person mind. And that's why the assignment was to use honesty beyond human honesty. Human honesty is forever confused. If we scroll down, we can go on to 438. .438 says, this world appearance is like a dream. This world appearance is like a dream. All right, here we go. It looks like another inquiry in the journal at 438. What makes the body world experience seem real when compared to a nighttime dream which is known to be unreal? So why would, you know, I or any other average person in the world say, my dream last night was not real, but this experience right now is? What causes us to make that distinguishing decision? Well, one is I wake up from a dream. The dream didn't last, right? It's temporary. It also doesn't make sense. It doesn't follow consistent physical laws, right? When you're trying to tell somebody your dream, you have to say, well, one moment I was here and in this place with these people, and then in the next moment I was here. You know, there's a consistent theme in my story, which is what I'm trying to tell you, but I quickly change locations, right? Or we might say that we flew. You know, the way I fly is so funny in a dream because it's not even the way birds fly. I start in a upright position pedaling like an invisible bike. And I have to pedal really hard till I get up high enough. And then when I get up high enough, it's as if I've broken gravity and then I can kind of stretch out and fly like a bird. But I have to pedal this invisible bike to get up high enough. You know, I mean, dreams just don't actually make sense compared to the physics that we, quote, know is real, unquote. And so because dreams are temporary, we wake up from them and they don't follow consistent physical laws, we know they're not real. That's how we know they're not real. The next question is, what makes the nighttime dream seem real while you're dreaming it? Because it is true. Even when I'm pedaling that bike, that invisible bike, trying to get high enough so I can fly, in that moment I think it's real. In fact, in that moment, I even have memories of doing it before. I can compare to whether I'm having more trouble pedaling the bike this time, more trouble breaking gravity, or less trouble breaking gravity than before, right? I have memories in my dreams of situations that never actually occurred. I don't even think I ever dreamed them, but in my dream, there's like this whole lifetime is placed there, and I can have memories. I can see a place and I can have a remembrance of, ooh, I don't want to go there. I've been there before. I remember what happened there before. You know, this happens in dreams. The dream seems very real while I'm in it. So what makes the nighttime dream seem real while dreaming? One, I'm there. Two, the environment is outside of me. Right? Everything I see in the dream is outside of me. I cannot control the outside environment. You know, if something is chasing me, I can't make it stop. I got to run. If the gravity is hard that day, I got to pedal harder to get high enough to fly, right? I can't control the outside environment. It seems to run on a power of its own, as if it has its own reality. This is why a dream seems real. Well, does the world seem real for the same reasons? Well, let's see. Does the world seem real because I'm there? Yeah. Yeah, I gotta say so. Does the world seem real because the environment is outside of me? Yeah. Does the world seem real because I cannot control the outside environment? It seems to run on a power of its own as if it has its own reality? Yeah. Is the nighttime dream real? No. So are these characteristics proof of reality? Does the fact I am there prove it's real? No. Because I'm there in a nighttime dream and I know that's not real. Does the fact that the environment is outside of me, is that proof of reality? No, because the environment is outside of me in a nighttime dream, and that's not real. Is the fact that I cannot control the outside environment, it seems to run on a power of its own, is that proof of reality? No, because that happens in a nighttime dream too, and that's not reality. So these characteristics that I use to say that the world's real, I say the world's real because I'm here. I say the world's real because the environment is outside of me. I say the world is real because I can't control the environment. But those characteristics aren't proof of reality because they're all true in a nighttime dream too. So even the fact that I'm here, that the world's outside of me, that I can't control it, that is not proof that it exists, and I know it's not proof that it exists because that's all true in a nighttime dream too, and I know the nighttime dream is not real. So these things are not proof of reality. Do you know that you will not wake up from the body world experience? Remember I said up above, I said one way that I know a dream is not real is because I wake up from it. Well, this is saying that do you know that you will not wake up from this? No, I do not know that awakening will not occur. In fact, I'm kind of operating on faith that it will. Will this body world experience continue indefinitely or will it end? Well, I know it will end. At the very least, in our experience, it ends for everyone at what we call death. I set up above that I know a dream's not real because it ends. It's temporary. But now I have to agree, well, this lifetime also ends. It's also temporary. It has that same criteria. The criteria that I use to say I know a dream is not real is because it ends. Now I'm realizing, but this is going to end too. So why do I call it real? Does the world make sense? Now then I saw very quickly something, and I said, I see this as an invalid criteria for reality since make sense is an opinion. In other words, what makes sense to me, and I say the world is real because it makes sense, may not make sense to someone else. You know, at one time, in my paradigm, something like a broken bone spontaneous healing would not make sense. But then that happened to me. I broke my toe and it spontaneously healed. So now for me that does make sense, but for my dad it still wouldn't make sense. So make sense isn't a valid criteria. You know, that's an opinion. If we say does it make sense, there's no way to consistently judge what makes sense means. So I said, I understand that's not a good criteria. So then the question was reworded to be more specific. Does the world always follow consistent physical laws? Do bones always heal? No. No. That I know. Sometimes bones break and a spontaneous healing happens. Sometimes bones break and there is not a spontaneous healing and a cast is needed. Sometimes people get cancer and there's a spontaneous healing of their cancer. Sometimes people get cancer, there is not a spontaneous healing, and the person appears to die. There's not a consistent law. And in fact, one of the things that we sometimes struggle with is trying to explain why these laws aren't consistent. Why don't all cancers heal? You know, when we believed in an external God, it was really cruel because it looked like sometimes God loved somebody enough to heal the cancer and sometimes God didn't. That hurt, that thinking that way. But do you know what this is saying? This is saying it's not consistent because it's not real. Dreams are not consistent. Ah. The only reason I thought it should be consistent is because I thought it was real. I thought that either bones heal or bones don't. Cancer heals or cancer doesn't, right? It never occurred to me that dreams are inconsistent, and the inconsistency itself is actually proof that the world is not real. And in fact, something happened right here in this part of the inquiry. Just to put an exclamation point on this for me. A few days before this inquiry occurred, I received an envelope in the mail. It was a charity wanting me to donate. And they did what they sometimes do. They taped a dime and a penny, 11 cents, in the envelope, and I can't remember what their spiel was. You know, somehow they wanted me to send them $35 because they sent me 11 cents. I don't remember what it was. But you know, they do that sometimes. I took the dime and the penny out of the envelope before I threw the whole thing away, and I put the dime and the penny upstairs on the shelf that I have in my kitchen, my dining room, actually. That was 3 days before this inquiry, I think. The day before this inquiry, I happened to walk by the shelf. I had left the 11 cents sitting there. I'd never touched it. I walk by the shelf, and the dime was still there, but the penny was gone. And I was thinking to myself, I was thinking, isn't that funny that somebody would take the penny and not the dime? Like, you know. Usually we think pennies are worthless. Like, you'd think if somebody saw that 11 cents and they wanted it, they would have taken the whole thing. Or they would have taken the dime and left the penny. But if somebody took the penny and left the dime, and I just thought it was funny, you know, that somebody needed a penny. The day of this inquiry, when right after this question was written down, does the world always follow consistent physical laws? I'm sitting in the basement in a seat that's directly below my bathroom, not directly below my dining room, directly below my bathroom. And all of a sudden, something comes falling from above and lands on the table next to me. And I look over, and it's that penny. That penny. It still had the stickiness on it from when it was in the envelope, so I know it was the same penny. I look up above me, there's not even a vent above me. And again, the room above me isn't even the dining room. So, like, I can't find a logical explanation. If I had been directly below a vent and directly above the dining room, I would have said a couple of days ago it fell into that vent, and just now it managed to work its way through the vent and it fell on me. You know, I would make up a story to explain it because that's what minds do. I couldn't explain how this penny just now, right after I wrote the question, does the world always follow consistent physical laws, fell and landed next to me. There's no vent above me, none at all, and I'm not even directly below the dining room. I'm directly below another part of the house. So I had to write, I cannot say that the world always follows consistent physical laws. No friggin' way. A penny that disappeared 2 days ago just appeared. Right here, right now. And I have no way of explaining it. The best explanation I have is that it happened so that I would realize clearly that the world does not follow consistent physical laws. So that I would realize clearly that in spite of the fact that I'm here and that the environment is outside of me and I cannot control the environment, the idea that the world is real is still just an idea and there's no proof of it. In fact, there's what we use as proof that the world is real also is what makes a dream seem real. And what we use to say, but I know the dream is not real because of dot, 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 like a dream does not follow consistent physical laws, well, guess what? Neither does this world. That's why pennies fall from heaven. That's why some cancers heal and some don't. Some broken bones heal and some don't. It's not consistent. It's not consistent, and we can't make it consistent. It's not consistent because it's not real. So we should stop trying to make the world consistent and start accepting its lack of consistency as proof that it's not real. You know what? Reality is consistent. If the world were real, then cancer would always heal or always wouldn't. It'd be consistent. The fact that it's not consistent is actually evidence that the world is not real. The inquiry continues at the bottom. Then, is it true that the body world experience is clearly distinguishable from a dream? Now you have to remember at this point I'm holding that penny in my hand. That sticky penny. No, it is not true that body world experience is clearly distinguishable from a dream. In fact, there may be more evidence that body world experience is a dream. They, meaning body world experience and a dream, share the same characteristics. I mean, if you print this out and look at this, really look at this, you're going to notice that a world and a nighttime dream have exactly the same characteristics. So why do we say that one is real and one isn't? That doesn't make any sense. All right, let's scroll down and click on number 439. Okay, I don't know this person, Bairnsons, I don't know how to say your name, sorry, forgive me, but you said you've read something very similar in the books of the French philosopher, and then I can't say this one either, Baudrillard, Baudrillard. I am certain that everyone who has awoken or come near awakening has had to have come to these realizations. I in no way perceive that these realizations are unique. I would say these realizations are very common to the awakening mind, which is why awakened teachers from all cultures, all times, all religions, all teach that the world is an illusion. It's because they've come to see this for themselves. The mistake that we sometimes make is that we hear the teaching the world is not real and we accept it as a belief. And a belief is not real. So if I'm believing that the world is not real, I may say it over and over again, it's not real, it's not real, it's not real. But then again, when my financial situation enters crisis, I'm still stressed because underneath it, there's still a belief that it is real. It's just one belief covering another belief. But when people speak from wisdom and say it's not real, they have seen that. These realizations have come to them. Somehow their penny fell from heaven like mine did. And they had to admit, no, there's nothing here any more real than a nighttime dream. You want to go outside, my love? Jamie wants to go outside. Let's see, I think I already gave you the link to 439. So when I get right back, I'll read from the book and we'll do that last one for today.
We'll go outside, my love.
All right, 439 in the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening says, on the awakening of the inner intelligence, the world perception ceases and there arises psychological freedom or non-attachment. That is known as emancipation. Again, on the awakening of the inner intelligence, the world perception ceases, and there arises psychological freedom, or non-attachment. That is known as emancipation. All right, let's look at 439 in the journal. Are you willing to wait patiently for awakening in order to see fully? Or do you need, crave, full awakening now? And the word crave is here for a reason. It's because of the feeling of what the question was asking. You know, it's so funny because if you look at just words, these teachings can seem to conflict. You know, like if you read The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss by Michael Langford, he is very insistent that you need to desire awakening far more than anything else. NTI teaches that your desire for awakening needs to become full, and by full it means there is no desire for anything else. The only thing that you desire is awakening. And that's true. But that desire comes from the heart. There's also an ego craving for awakening that isn't the same thing. And I don't know how to explain the difference right this moment. Maybe it will come, but maybe you guys know the difference. There's an ego craving for awakening, which when it is fed, we're actually feeding ego. Just like when you're feeding any other ego thought. So when that craving arises, which is different than the true desire, the craving needs to be let go. And that's when you will find people saying things like, I am willing to be patient and wait for awakening. It will happen when it happens. Those types of statements are used to let go of the unhealthy craving. However, the healthy desire can still be nursed. And in fact, it's helpful to continue to feed the healthy desire. So the trick is to learn the difference between the desire, the healthy desire for awakening, and the ego craving. If I was to just look at myself and describe how I know the difference between the two, there's a sense of stress in the craving. there's a sense of lack in the craving. Like, if I'm not awake, I lack something right now. Hold on, Jamie wants back in. There could be a sense of guilt or a sense of unworthiness in the craving, like I'm not as good as others who are awake. A sense of being left out. A sense of self-judgment. You know, you never meditate enough. You never, you know, you're bad because you're not given it enough. It has all of the characteristics of ego in the craving. Because ego is ego. Whether ego is having a grievance against your neighbor or craving awakening, it still has the footprint of ego. The desire is different. The desire for awakening, it actually does have patience in it. And yet, even within the patience, there's something that calls us forth into contemplations, into meditations, into forgiveness practices. But the reason it has a patience in it, I guess, is because it doesn't have a sense of lack. It's not preaching that there's a lack now. And so because of the absence of lack, there's the sense of patience. The desire, the way I experience it, feels like love. It presently feels like love. Not like someday I'll get love, but it presently feels like love. Even as it's calling me forth into more love, it's already in love. If you imagine a tunnel somewhere, if you imagine that the path of awakening is a tunnel to light, but that entire tunnel is made out of love. You're already in the love when you're in that desire, even though it's still calling you forth. But you're not outside of the love trying to get to it. You are in the love even during the journey. This particular month has been a little unusual for me. I'm enjoying it very much, but it's been very unusual in that this year has primarily been a practice of spending my mornings, 2 or 3 hours in my mornings, in quietness with the seven steps. That's kind of been the habit of the year. It started just when Jay and I went to India last year, so it's been a full year of doing this. What's happened since I hit December 1, and it was completely unplanned and unexpected, is I began to listen to Christmas carols. And like I've told you guys, I'm spending literally hours a day sitting and listening to Christmas carols. Now, this is not something the personality of Regina would do. And yet, it's how I'm being called. I am being called to sit and listen to Christmas carols. Now, the mind that craves awakening tried a little bit. I didn't listen to it, so it wasn't successful. But it tried a little bit to tell me that I'm wasting time. I should be doing the seven steps. Like something was wrong. It came as a voice of judgment, telling me that something was wrong. And it had that sense of lack in it. And that sense of you're bad in it. But the love in my heart is calling me to listen to Christmas carols. Right now. So I'm following the love, trusting that it knows what it's doing, and I'm not worrying about what the voice of the craving is saying. And I don't understand why I would do seven steps less and Christmas carols a lot this month. But I only know that's what the heart is doing. So again, back to number 439. Are you willing to wait patiently for awakening in order to see fully, or do you need, meaning crave, full awakening now? And my answer was, I see that the one who waits patiently or struggles hard with dissatisfaction. Oh, I was seeing something different that day. I'll get back to that in a second. Let me finish reading and then I'll tell you what I saw. I see that the one who waits patiently or struggles hard with dissatisfaction is imposter self. I see I is unaffected by all of mind's ideas, including ideas of world, imposter self, and awakening. So I just spoke to you about the difference between the ego craving and the heart desire to awaken. And we follow the heart desire. But what this is really talking about is who even follows the heart desire. The truth is, the awakened mind is always awake. The awakened mind did not fall asleep. And therefore, the awakened mind does not need to follow the heart into awakening. Now, this doesn't mean that I won't continue that experience of following the heart into awakening. But what this is again pointing out, and it's really, at least for me at this point, very important, it's again pointing out where my attention and focus needs to be. Even while following the heart into awakening, my attention focus is best served if it stays with the changelessness. And this is probably what takes me to experiences like I described at the beginning of this teaching, where I'm watching the personality and I'm watching the movement. You know, I there's an experience of watching Regina listen to Christmas carols. There's an experience of watching Regina, you know, have thoughts, you know, I should be doing seven steps. Oh, but my heart says do Christmas carols, so I'll do Christmas carols. Like, that's the movie, and I'm watching the movie. When that experience is in place, the watching of the Regina sitting down to teach, in that experience, there's more truth to that experience than there is to the experience, I am Regina following the heart. The watcher of the following the heart is more true than I am the one following the heart. And so awakening, which is also called remembrance, is best served even as we seem to be following the heart, even as this movement still happens, right? Like I said, I can watch the personality have thoughts like, I don't want to teach, I want to go finish my Christmas shopping. And then I can watch the body sit down and teach, right? It's because the body is following the heart right now. But the watcher, that experience I have sometimes, like I said, it comes and goes, but it's becoming more and more common. That experience of the watcher is a more true experience than the experience of I am following my heart. Because the one who follows the heart is illusory. So that heart following is still going to happen. That's what's interesting. This is not a teaching of don't follow the heart. The heart following is still going to happen. The heart following is still, for lack of better words, a better choice over following ego. Right? We go from ego to real world to awakening. That's the way the Course is laid out. That's like going from ego to heart following to awakening. But what this inner wisdom is doing is pointing towards awakening. And it's going to say, it's saying what's most helpful now is not to identify with the heart following. Let the heart following continue, but notice whether the heart is being followed or whether it's not. Notice the changelessness. That's what's most helpful. So it's kind of like moving a step beyond. The first step was to learn discernment between right mind and wrong mind. We learned discernment. We learned to follow the right mind. Now it's saying, now you're doing a pretty good job of following the right mind. Let's take the next step. Even as you follow the right mind, notice that's not what you are. Start noticing what you are, that which was the same, even when you used to choose to follow the wrong mind. What has not changed? And focus on that. And I think I'm out of time. So I will let go of the mic and I'll be back on Thursday with Lynn. You guys have a good week. Bye.